Good morning. This is Just Life. I'm Di Redmond, and I have three guests in the studio this morning talking about Ukraine and their work there. My guests this morning are Alia. Alia, can you please pronounce your last name so I don't make a terrible mistake?
Aralbaeva.
Alia, very pleased to have you on the programme. Dominic Proctor, who was on a programme not long ago, Songs in the Wilderness, and Daniel Whitehead from London. So can we start with you, Alia? Tell me about your role and your work, and perhaps you can tell us of your recent experiences.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I say that sometimes that it all, I was very fortunate that it all started with me from my home. Oh. For someone from a different cultural background, and I was born and raised in the former Soviet Union in Kazakhstan, our charity, Medical Lifelines Ukraine, and everything that has happened over the last 2 years has been a remarkable achievement. I sometimes say that this is the best thing that happened in my life, that we managed to help Ukrainian healthcare sector. And obviously after giving birth to my children and getting married. But although the savage for the war, for the atrocity, and for the reason we started this beautiful thing is to never happen. So our charity was born on February 25th, just 24 hours after the Russian army invaded Ukraine. If anyone asks why 24 hours later, this is because our family, and I have my husband is a Ukrainian, born and grew up in Kyiv. Yes, we have a family in Kyiv, and like many others, we could not cope with the devastating news. No one could believe it, but it was happening. The war was in the headlines of the world media. People began to express their opinion. People came to protest in Trafalgar Square, and Russians and Ukrainians, our friends in London, they began to argue. Friendship began to disintegrate. And it was then, 24 hours later, that I sent a message to 300 mothers in Wimbledon proposing some plan of action. And I think it was something that everyone was waiting for. This is how I started a fundraising to purchase medical aid and ambulances for Ukrainian hospitals, because the emotional support in the very beginning was massive. The appeal received huge support, and my own family home turned into a warehouse. And people started gathering at my place, and from 1 week's donations, we bought several boxes of life-saving trauma medicine and three ambulances, which we filled with medical aid donated by people, by community and hospitals, and sent to Ukraine. Our first ambulances arrived to Kyiv on 5th of March, and that was so early. We reported back to donors with photographs and thank you notes from hospitals, and received even more financial support. People started believing us. And of course, you won't be surprised if I say that sending ambulances to Ukraine was not an easy task. I remember sitting down with old committee members, which included three Ukrainian mothers and myself, and my fellow committee members decided to stop sending ambulances because the operations were too stressful, too risky, and too responsible. And that evening, I thought, if all this stress and all this effort will help to save at least one human life, and despite all the stress and responsibility, it would all be worth it. That's how it started. And later in June 22, we turned the page and we started a completely new chapter with Sally, Jared, and Strauss, and Daniel Whitehead. And Dan is here today. And I have to say, I was very, very fortunate to have found them, and they're extraordinary individuals with biggest, most kind hearts and great sense of empathy. And together, with Dan, Sally, and Jerry, the charity moved on a completely different level. It is now a successful operation that has its own life and reputation.
So this sounds amazing. First of all, you're all in Wimbledon. Clearly that must have been pretty handy that you all were very passionate and converged. And you say your house was a meeting place to start with, at least.
Yes, a headquarters. Sometimes neighbors would joke that it looks so busy. You know, there's all the ambulances parked outside the house.
Oh, really? You had the ambulances there?
The old war will not start from this address. it was a headquarters, medical.
But what's wonderful, because I don't think any of us will ever forget that night when we heard the news that Ukraine was, you know, being invaded, was, what can I do? What can I do? Where can I go? And the fact that you kicked off so quickly and you were so energised and organised that you had, well, from what I've just heard, like within a couple of days, you were getting stuff out there and you had ambulances. Where did the ambulances come from, out of curiosity?
In the very beginning, yes, we were buying whatever was available, and there were quite few ambulances available on the market. A few Ukrainians with mechanical background helped me to buy a few ambulances. They were sending their own ambulances to their contacts, and joined their effort. And it was easy. It was not that difficult to source and find ambulances in the very beginning, but later it became quite it's a responsible task and not an easy operation. And I think that Dan will tell you more about it.
Right. Before I talk to Daniel, can I ask you, Dominic, to tell us about who? Dominic's just arrived back at the weekend from, was it Kyiv? Did you deliver to Kyiv?
Lviv.
Right. Yeah. And so you have a clip that you want us to hear from, you interviewed somebody live there.
I interviewed a few people, Diane. The first clip, it's a shortish clip, but I think it puts into perspective what Ilya was just talking about. This is from a local politician in Lviv. And it really just shows the value of having someone like Ilya and her contacts, because the great value of this charity that it brings, I think, to the whole enterprise is the contacts that Ilya and her colleagues have on the ground with the politicians, with the medical people there. And so getting an interview was not tricky, but very instructive. So maybe we could just play the tape of the interview with Natalia Pieper, please.
So here we are, broadcasting to Radio Maria. I'm speaking to you from a cafe in Lviv in Ukraine, and I'm delighted to say that we have a very special guest here, which is Natalia Pieper. Natalia is a member of the parliament here in Ukraine, representing Lviv in the national parliament. She's come literally overnight and during the day today from Kyiv back to Lviv, her constituency, to join us for dinner. Thank you for coming, first of all. And perhaps you
can
just...
Thank you. You have a long trip.
Well, we've come a long way as well. Yeah, we have. But we've just finished giving the ambulances to the hospitals, and it's wonderful to see the faces of the people that we've been bringing the medical aid to. It's very, very life-affirming. It's a wonderful thing to have done. I'm sure our listeners, though, would be interested to hear just briefly what your own interpretation of the war currently is. Do you feel still the love from outside? Do you feel that the Russians are still being horribly aggressive? How do you see it unfolding?
Yes, we feel that Russians are terrible, and something missiles that we have today, like Kinjals and other, is like 20s. It was near my house in Kyiv. And you know, all time it is, you feel that your world will be crashed in the moment, yes, where go missiles. It is like every time you are afraid in your way. And it is like the biggest question, why and for what? But yes, you don't have an answer for it. It's just my to go and fight for freedom and to survive and yes, to have opportunity just to live with family and to be.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's crucial. Well, thanks for coming again. It's been a pleasure to meet you. And thanks very much indeed for the fact that you, amongst other politicians here, are so welcoming as well. And you make it easy. You make it easy to be a charity partner. You guys are heroes. We really do appreciate it.
Thank you. And you know, I'm from non-governmental organization, from Catholic University. I'm from Scout organization. Something that you do is very close to me, because before war, I made something very similar to people that really need. And today, I really thank you, British people, for your leadership in the Second World War and for your leadership in the world today, and for every pound that you spent for peace, democracy, and humanity in this world.
Well, Natalia Pipa, thank you again so much. Good luck with everything, and you can be certain that not just the listeners to Radio Maria, but the UK population will remain steadfastly behind you. Good luck.
Thank you.
You have to mention the website, of course.
Okay, and we will ask you together to don't stop to help, because it is something that help us survive and help survive the peace in the world. And it is like medicallifelines.org.uk. Click donate, and every pound will be in the right place. And really thank you for it.
There we go. So Medical Lifelines, all one word, Medical Lifelines. .org.uk. Natalia, thank you.
Dominic, thank you for that. It sounds extraordinary. Where did you meet her?
What was quite funny, Di, was that this is the classic. She was a classic politician, because she ticked me off at the end because I forgot to ask her to mention the website, but she was straight on it. So she knows, she was living proof that they need our love and they need our medicine, but they need our money too. So she was keen to remind me to get the website out there.
But how did you track her down? Did you just bump into her?
No. Through Aaliyah and her contacts. This is the great thing about having Aaliyah and her group out there, because they're so well connected into the Ukrainian infrastructure, political, medical, and military, and they fixed it all. So we had a dinner last Thursday night, actually, a small dinner of people who came along, and we just broke off the dinner and had a conversation.
But Aaliyah, how do you have all these political contacts? Is it just people you've just kept in touch with, and it just seems like quite a tour de force to.
In the very beginning, I mentioned my husband. He's Ukrainian. Yes, Andrei. He's a geneticist, and he works in the UK and has a business in Ukraine. And through him, we had first contacts in the healthcare sector. And because of Andrei's contacts, we managed to send all the ambulances to the right places in the very beginning. But since then, we found our own contacts, and yes, they are in the healthcare sector. We work with the state emergency services of Ukraine, and now we have quite a few MPs in Ukraine supporting us. And yes, I think it's the result of 2 years of operations that help us to grow our contacts.
It's wonderful. It's a wonderful network. Let's take a music break. When I Needed a Neighbour.
Freedom, the power of the neighbors was for you there.
That was When I Needed a Neighbour. This morning I'm speaking to three amazing people from Wimbledon, Elia, Dominic and Daniel. And they're part of a huge movement, Medical Lifeline Ukraine, speaking to us on Just Life this morning. Thank you again for coming. Daniel, could you tell us about your input and connection with Ilya and Dominic? And it sounds like the whole of Wimbledon out there.
It certainly feels like it.
I wish I was part of it. I envy you very much.
Come to Wimbledon, it's lovely. I just after having had the music break, it is of course music that got me involved. I had no connection with Ukraine at all before the invasion. And a mutual friend of mine, a singing buddy, who's a friend of Aliyah's, was holding a music afternoon early in the summer in 2022, and thought it'd be a great idea to raise the profile of what Aliyah was doing, broadened her circle of contacts locally and so on. And so a whole bunch of people went over to her house one afternoon to perform, play instruments and sing and so on. And I thought, wow, what Aliyah is doing is absolutely amazing. It's incredible that something like that on that scale, that's engaging with an issue this important, is happening right in my community. So I thought, right, I'll go along and meet her. And I chair a choir where I live called Academy Choir Wimbledon. And we had a concert coming up, and I said, well, would you like to bring one of your ambulances along to our concert? Because we'll have 300 people there or something. That will help to raise your profile. No, and she thought, oh, that's a lovely idea. Great. I'd love to do that. So Aliyah turns up, and I saw Aliyah before the concert started. And I said to Aliyah, where's the ambulance? And she said, oh, it's on the street outside. And I'd arranged with the church, Sacred Heart Church in Wimbledon, which is, it's a massive, it's almost like a cathedral. It's got a big, hard standing area. I'd arranged with them that it'd be okay to park the ambulance in the front. And it wasn't there. And so I said, Aliyah, where is it? And she said, well, it's on the street outside. The gateway is a bit narrow to get the ambulance through. And I said, well, they get a hearse through there. It must be possible to get an ambulance through. And so Aliyah said, would you mind driving it? So I said, oh, good. She just asked a boy if he'd like to drive an ambulance. The answer is obviously going to be yes.
Can I put the flashes on?
Yeah, exactly. Like, child alert. So I backed it in and parked it nicely in front of the church. And Aliyah said, oh, that was amazing. Would you like to drive it to Ukraine? And I thought, well, I've driven 30 metres backwards. I mean, 1,000 miles forward has got to be easy.
What a wonderful introduction.
May I just add that it took Daniel 10 seconds to reverse into the churchyard, whereas for me it was absolutely impossible task.
And also, you're being very modest about the size of, I do know which church you're talking about, and it's not a big space, it's quite narrow.
It was okay. As I said, I thought if they can get a hearse in, then an ambulance is much bigger, so it must be possible. Anyway, so I went to see my wife, who's a member of the choir. We met singing in a choir, a different choir. And so I said to her, Aliyah's just asked if, I'd like to drive an ambulance to Ukraine, expecting absolutely not. And my wife said, yes, I'd love to go. So it looks like we are driving an ambulance to Ukraine. So then on our wedding anniversary, and I wouldn't like anybody to read anything into the fact that it's our wedding anniversary on which we set off for a war zone, we drove our first ambulance the first ambulance I had driven out, which I think was the 12th that Aliyah had arranged, out to Ukraine.
Can I just
that was what started it.
Can I just ask a question? Because I cannot imagine, and I'd love you to clarify, you're sitting in the ambulance, your wife is next to you, and the ambulance is absolute chocker, and you've just got the sat-nav on and a ticket. I mean, how does it work practically, just actually rolling out? I mean, do you have a flask and a load of sandwiches and some Valium to keep you going? I mean, it just sounds Herculean to me.
Well, it's very much like that, actually. you've painted a very accurate picture, apart from the Valium, I'd like to point out. The distance to drive to Ukraine is similar to the distance to drive, for example, to southern Italy or to Portugal. So it's a drive that a lot of people do in terms of distance in a summer holiday. It's not something that's unusual. If anyone's listening in America, it's similar, I think, to New York to Miami, for example. It's not a You say Herculean. It's actually something that in other circumstances people would undertake, not every day, but people would undertake without too much thought. So, and that's one of the points, is Ukraine is actually really close. You know, the closest working airport is Krakow, probably, in Poland,
yeah.
And that's just over a 2-hour flight. And so, you know, that puts us into scale into quite how close Ukraine is to the UK. So we organise now. We've now got much more of a system around things than we did then. Now that we're sending convoys, so we work with Eurotunnel Freight to give us free one-way tickets, which is very good of them. And then we book accommodation along the way for stops, so that people are, you know, don't get too tired, and we stay within acceptable limits for safety and so on and so forth. And then we have a last night in Poland near the border. And it's important to stress that no driver is encouraged to enter Ukraine. In fact, everybody's encouraged not to enter Ukraine, because obviously the UK, US and other governments recommend, understandably, against going into a country that's at war. But a lot of our drivers make their own assessment, say, you know what, it is something that I want to do. I'm happy doing it. If drivers don't want to go into Ukraine, then we can have volunteers come out of Ukraine to collect the ambulances. We can leave them in Ukraine.
But what's the distances? I mean, at what point, if you stop outside the border, what would be the distance to the pickup, to the transfer? And how do you protect the contents of everything that's in that ambulance?
Yeah, so we have, if for example, let's say the situation in Ukraine was awful when, you know, in terms of missile attacks and so on, even in Western Ukraine, and we took the decision, look, it's just madness to go in at the moment. Mm. Then we have secure location in Eastern Poland where we can leave the ambulances, and then we can wait until the Ukrainians who are living there, of course, you know, we just pop out, collect the ambulances and get them back in.
I think, Dan, if I can say that Alia and Dan are being very characteristically modest about this. It might not be that far to drive. It's 1,200 miles or so, as Dan pointed out. But what they do brilliantly is organise all the logistics of actually getting into the country. Because if you think about the admin involved in bringing vehicles and pharmaceuticals and equipment into a war zone, and the caution that the border guards are going to have around that, as well as the customs officers, then you can imagine that's a big enterprise. So it is, Dan's right, it's relatively easy to drive there, sort of straight line from Calais all the way through from Belgium, Holland, Germany, Poland. But then the value really comes from the charity locally to get the vehicles through.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm thinking of. And also, you could never let that out of your sight. I mean, the fact that you're in it, but you're also protecting so much valuable equipment. And how do you ensure that it gets to where it has to go? And there's apart from being bombed, that, you know, that there's it's never tampered with. Are you with the goods all the time?
Yeah. Yeah, with the goods all the time. I mean, obviously, when you're in the west of Europe, it's not so difficult. You're just parking in the road and the hotels we stay in next to the motorways on the way. That's all perfectly secure. And then Lviv itself. What Alia and her team have got is the network of representatives of all of the regions who've requested help, who then come to our central hotel in Lviv, where the contents of the ambulances get emptied, parceled up, changed, moved around, and distributed to them. Who then take the ambulances, fully refurbished and hopefully going to last several years, God willing. They then take them back themselves to the destinations on the ground at the battle lines where they're needed.
And
so the central hub in Lviv, and then onwards through the locals to the destinations.
And how do you get back?
Well, the easiest way back is to get a car, literally get an Uber or equivalent to back to the border, which is about 80 kilometres, a couple of hours maybe. Getting over the border again is a challenge. That's 2 or 3 hours, 4 hours actually, as it happened on Friday, because it was a bit tense. and then a train from the border to Krakow, as Dan mentioned. That's the nearest airport, international airport, really, with flights, and then from there back. I say that's the easiest way, because I should point out one of our number, Julian, decided to take a slightly trickier way back. He's cycling.
Oh, he's
cycling.
Oh, can it get any harder?
It can't get any harder.
Is he really going to cycle all the way back?
As we speak, he's crossed the border, thank goodness, from Ukraine into Poland after a couple of days.
Alleluia.
And he's now somewhere in Poland with two Ukrainian flags, and we bought him a pair of blue tights and a pair of yellow tights, so one on each leg, half of a Ukrainian flag on each leg, and there he is cycling somewhere in the middle of Poland, oblivious to all of this, quite happily taking 2 weeks to get home.
So surely he's going to collect money on the way. He must have set up a charity or, you know, donate here, because he'll make thousands.
I think he already has.
Good, good.
Yeah.
We'll take a break for our next piece of music. Do we know what this is?
Yes, this is a Ukrainian song. I don't want to dare try and pronounce it, but it's about a flower, a well-known flower in Ukraine. So perhaps afterwards, maybe Dominic, Dan and Alia might be able to tell us something more about it.
Haunting song there. Ilya, can you tell us the title? Tell us what it's about?
My husband, who is Ukrainian, says it's a song called Chernobrivtsi, which is marigold flower. This song was written in the 60s and sung by famous Ukrainian singers. Yes, that's
beautiful, you know. Music. Lovely, lovely. So could you each tell me some of your experiences on the ground in Ukraine, what it's actually like to be there, and some of the, as I say, the experiences you've gone through. Can I start with you, Daniel? You've been back six times now.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's interesting, because I think the first few times I went, I got the distinct sense that there was an odd sense of suspicion. That Ukrainians didn't quite understand why you were turning up with a valuable ambulance filled with aid and giving it to people and then turning around and leaving. That there had to be a catch. There had to be some kind of trade-off that you were after. This was not a concept that I think that a lot of them had grown up with, the idea of, I have something, you need it. It is the right thing to do for me to help you. One of our drivers on our most recent convoy, Frank Lavin, who's a former US diplomat, posted recently on LinkedIn, actually, about the dinner that Dom was talking about earlier on, when we organize our drivers get to meet a bunch of the local contacts that we have and understand firsthand the impact that what they have just done is going to have on people in Ukraine. And Frank gave a toast, and one of the local Ukrainians was didn't seem quite engaged, didn't seem quite happy, was processing something. He wasn't 100% present, if you like, and he managed to ask him later on. And I'll just quote from Frank's LinkedIn post very quickly, if I may. This chap said to him, "I went to a Russian military academy. All my life I was taught to hate the Americans and the British. All my adult life, I've been trying to understand that much of my education was a lie. Now I have found one more lie." It's incredibly powerful. The human impact that what we do has is incredible. And the Ukrainians themselves, when you're speaking to them about the most awful things that have happened to them, they are facing an incredibly powerful mechanized military that's having a direct impact on every single Ukrainian, and they relate what they're what their experience is in a very calm, factual, utterly engaging way. Mm. And
Dan, perhaps I could just jump in on that.
Engaging.
Dominic.
Sorry. No, only because I was at the dinner with Frank, obviously, and I was sitting on the other side of the man you, Roman, his name was, who was in charge of the ambulance and emergency services up near the border with Belarus. And Alia was translating for, he had Frank, the diplomat, on one side and myself on the other. And whilst he was saying these things, he stopped and literally choked and started crying.
Oh.
And we couldn't stop him crying. And Frank and I said, and he couldn't speak the word in English, so we were free to say, I hope he's all right. Has he just got some bad news on his text or something like that? And Alia asked him why he was crying, and it was a very difficult conversation because he couldn't stop. And when he had time to stop crying, he said, I've been taught all my life to hate Americans, looking at Dan, looking at Frank, and Brits looking at me, and I'm just so embarrassed about that. I feel so bad about that. I've lived a lie.
That is yes, I can imagine how embarrassed you were.
He added, Roman added, that I could not, if in the past he would never believe that he would be sitting at the same table and genuinely, sincerely, from the bottom of his heart, thanking British and Americans for the support to Ukraine. That's how he ended his very powerful, very emotional speech. Yes, and we all sat there at the table listening to him.
And that was only last week?
Thursday night.
Thursday.
I should add that he brought with him, we split into two tables of eight. There were 16 of us, and he brought two bottles of vodka. Each one was 2 litres. And he slapped one on one table, and he slapped one on the other table. But you'll be pleased to hear, Di, that they went largely undrunk. But
it would be very tempting. If I was coming back all the way, I'd be actually opening the bottle for everybody. But I had a similar experience on Friday. I wrote a book, a children's book, and the illustrator who lives in Zaporizhka, her town was bombed systematically all through the night. And the editor got in touch with me and said, get in, you know, we're trying to get in touch with Lilia, who lives with her grandmother and a dog. And I did get in touch, and very quickly she got back. And exactly what you're saying, upbeat, you know, very sort of positive, because I would say, are you OK? Is the house still standing? And she said, we have electricity, we have water, and we have some food. I was thinking, well, talk about working from a negative, you know. And then she sent pictures of the building, which was just like shattered. But it's this incredible spirit that I've met over and over and over again, particularly with the parents of the children that the book is aimed at, this incredible strength and determination that they'll win. It's just implacable. They'll win.
Should we go, Di? There's a clip we made on this, on the same dinner here, and Dan, we're referring to actually with our other guest at the dinner was a medical guy, and he really, it's slightly a longer clip. It's about a 5-minute clip, but I think if we can play that clip, that really brings this absolutely home, because it does talk about the children, it does talk about the medicine, it does talk about the humanitarian challenge that that we're all trying to help to find a solution to.
Who is the guy? Can you introduce him?
He's a guy, a fascinating man called Denis Surkov. And I'd say a little bit about him in the introduction to it. But your listeners at Radio Maria they won't remember his name probably, but they'll probably remember the incident that I referred to at the beginning of the interview, which kicked off his involvement in the struggle.
OK, let's hear it.
Here we are again in the cafe at the cinema in Lviv, and I have another very, very special guest, a hero, Denis Surkov. Denis is many things in the medical profession, but what he does here in Lviv is he looks after the children's hospital. He has all sorts of specialisms which are to do with how we fight the medical challenges that this dreadful war has brought. So I wanted just to get some perspective from Denis, but I thought Our listeners here on Radio Maria might recognise the story that kicked off Dennis's involvement, because Dennis was actually running the children's hospital in Dnipro when 2 years ago the Russians first invaded this beautiful country, Ukraine. When they first invaded, you might remember, across the Dnipro River, and they attacked the town and they attacked the children's hospital that Dennis was running 2 years ago. How was that, Dennis? That must have been shocking.
Mm-hmm. I was really shocking. I was, 2 years ago, I was chief of NICU in Dnipro city. And when we were under attack, under rocket attack, we didn't understand what is going on. Everyone was afraid, and our only main thought was how to save children, because we have no possibility to transfer them to underground or something like that. And you know, we didn't expect that.
Mm.
In fact, we didn't believe that.
Yes.
It was.
Yes.
It was started finally.
Yes.
Because we understood that Russian aggression could be started, but we didn't believe that they can attack by rocket for civilian, and it was horrible.
Into a children's hospital.
Yeah.
I mean, that was so aggressive.
It was horrible.
I remember the story. I don't remember, honestly, your name and your involvement, but I remember mm-hmm. the story very, very clearly, and shocked the world. It shocked the world. And then I think after that you moved with your family to Lviv.
Yep. No.
No.
I moved with my family to the western border.
Right.
Of
to
Ukraine,
the border.
Yes.
Yep.
To push my family to the safe places abroad.
Mm.
And I did that.
Yep.
Already 2 years we are separated.
Right.
And I live here in Lviv. And my
So you made them safe and then you came back?
Yep.
Right.
Yep. Because,
right.
you know, I need to struggle for my country, and I am a medical professional, and, you know, my country needs me.
Yeah.
So now we live in two countries.
Yeah.
I try, time to time, I can see my family. It's not so good for me, but anyway, these things are like now, and maybe in the future when war will be stopped, we will be able to once again to be with
let's hope so soon, Dennis. Let's hope so soon. And I guess the reason why you joined us for dinner is you feel very connected with the outside world, and you're very obviously obviously very grateful and very reliant on the aid that the outside the foreign world can bring.
You know, in fact, at the moment, what we really need, from one hand, we need for support by, I don't know, stuff, equipment, medicines, some, I don't know, goods and something like that. But you know, during these 2 years when I am here in Lviv, I recognize that the main ask from us to Western world is education.
Education,
training, and joint resources.
Yes.
Because now, for example, I am chief of infection control and prevention division in all our medical union.
Yeah.
And there is a big, big, huge challenge because microbiology resistance because of war is absolutely dramatic.
Right.
And at the moment there is no real instruments, no real, for example, antibiotics.
Yes.
To treat.
Yes.
So wounded soldiers,
yes,
as well as to prevent hospital acquired infections in kids.
So you need us not just to bring the equipment and the medicine, you need to be trained,
and we need to investigate what are mechanisms of antimicrobial resistance,
yeah,
and how we can outbreak them.
Right, right, right. Well, Dennis, you will certainly continue to have our support. I know there's lots of other challenges in the world, but certainly from the perspective of the listeners of Radio Maria, I know that they're going to stay firmly behind Ukraine on this. And look, I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't give a plug. So if you are listening and you do want to get behind Dennis and his team, Dennis, why don't you read out? I've written it down for you.
medicallifelines.org.uk. Click donate.
That's it.
And perfect. Thanks for Radio Maria.
Yep, medicallifelines.org.uk, and just click on donate. Dennis, you're a hero. You're an absolute hero.
I'm just a doctor.
Well, you're.
And I am just doing my job.
You're doing your job, but it's the sooner you have to stop doing your job because the war is finished, the better. But in the meantime, the best of luck.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Keep safe.
Thank you.
We're just going to have a music break. And if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to call in. The number is 01-223-375-564, 01-223-375-564. And we're going to listen to a little bit more music. It's another Ukrainian song, and we'll find out more about the song afterwards. But please don't hesitate to call in if you have any questions this morning about Medical Lifelines Ukraine.
Два кольори, мої два кольори, оба на полотні, в душі мої оба. Два кольори, мої два кольори.
Another beautiful piece of music. Alia, could you tell us the title of that? Do you know what it was? Is it familiar to you?
The song is called Two Colors. Red refers to love and black to sorrow. And it's a 60s song sung by famous American singer of Ukrainian origin, Kvitka Sisek.
Thank you. Amazing song. So we have a question from our president, Charles Wilson. Over to you, Charles.
Thanks, Di. Actually, first thing is a reflection, because Radio Maria also has a station in Ukraine, which is called Radio Maria Ukraine. And I was speaking to the priest director and a few months ago, and he was saying the biggest thing he has problems with is preaching about forgiveness. And we've always slightly alluded to it, that actually... It's a difficult time to be a Christian in there, in being able to preach about forgiveness when so much hurt is coming. But my question was really to both, well, all of you really, is, you know, it's a slightly cynical question, but we know about the level of corruption that exists. And how can you tell us that really what you're doing is, and all of the stuff is reaching its target and not being taken for other uses?
Thank you, Charles. I think that's a good question. It's one we get asked, and it's one we're obviously very sensitive to, because corruption remains an issue in Ukraine. It's much less of an issue now than it was several years ago, but when it was particularly rife. I think it's something that the government of Ukraine has been focusing on, but it's not perfectly addressed. I think Don touched on it earlier on, actually. I think talking about the connections that we have on the ground, which we put a lot of effort into developing and maintaining, so that we know the people that we are delivering the aid to. We can trace the aid from where we deliver it. Well, first we find out what is needed. We get that verified, whether that's aid, whether it's things like bandages or things for use in anesthesia, for example, or whether it's we know, for example, there's a massive need for trauma care in Ukraine, but what you need is to make sure that when you deliver aid of any type into Ukraine, that it's actually getting where it needs to go and will be used. There's no point somebody hoarding it and then using it as some kind of lever for power. So we're very careful about who we work with, and there are people that we will not work with. There are routes that we will not use to deliver aid, in terms of organizations that we will not partner with. We're very particular because it really matters. When I go out to raise money, when Dom goes out to raise money, or Ali or anybody else, you want to feel confident that when somebody gives £5 or £5,000, whatever it might be, that the money that they are giving is really going to help people. That really matters. So it's something that we're very, very, very focused on, to make sure that what we're doing, there aren't many links in the chain. You know, Dom was saying that he meets people who will be using the aid that we deliver. I was on a convoy in January, and we met medics working at the front line who will take the aid back and use it themselves to save lives. It's very immediate and very powerful that way. But I think it's a good question, and one I think people will be interested to hear the answer to. Thank you.
It's absolutely. I mean, I think as a newcomer to this, Charles, it was, what was really impressive to me was the scrutiny that the charity has given to that and the thought it's given to that, because it's summed up to me by having the shortest possible lines of supply and the shortest possible lines of communication. You know, the stuff literally never leaves our sight. And, you know, when you shake hands with the man who's going to drive your ambulance back to Kharkiv, full of the things that he personally has asked for to deal with his own patients, mm-hmm. that's a pretty short line of supply. You could look him in the eye. We're using no middlemen and agents mm-hmm. that we haven't met, and that's impressive.
Okay.
Well, yeah. Just to underscore that, Dom, one of the ambulances was handed over in Lviv, I think, on the Wednesday, and on the Thursday or the Friday, there were photographs of it at its destination hospital being unloaded by, you know, wonderful, grateful locals. And you think that's amazing. You know, you drive that across, I don't know whether it was the one that you drove actually, Wymo, yeah. But you see that very vehicle that you've driven from Wimbledon to Lviv, a day later it's in somewhere that desperately needs that support and doing a great deal of good.
So my next question is, how do you get your ambulances? We have an ambulance station right around the corner from the studio, and I was almost tempted to go down and knock on their door and say, what happens to your old ambulances? So how do you source them, and how do you get them, and do you still need more?
Oh, we always need more. We're very happy to get our hands on ambulances. We're quite particular about the vehicles that we buy, because we tend to start with the demand side. I think a number of groups will be desperate to do the right thing, and they'll get what they think will be useful, and they'll find a way of delivering it to Ukraine. We start from a slightly different position, which is to ask people what they need, and then we go out and get what they need, and they deliver that, and then we deliver that to the people who will be using it. So we always need ambulances. We buy them from, there are, I now know, having had nothing to do with either Ukraine or ambulances until I got involved with this, ambulance dealers. There are people who operate fleets of ambulances when they become surplus to requirements for the NHS, or on private fleets when people, you know, replace them with brand new, more swanky versions. Those ambulances come up for sale. We buy them. We recondition them. So we'll often do quite a lot of mechanical work on them. We'll replace cam belts, brake discs and pads. Sometimes, you know, they may need, for example, turbos replaced. They may need quite a lot of work done on them sometimes. Other times they're in better condition. But we want to deliver to Ukraine vehicles that are useful, not vehicles that are going to be millstones. So if you imagine when you go to your mechanic, and the mechanic says, oh, you don't really need to change this just yet, you'll probably be okay for another 6-12 months. And you say, okay, that's great, I'll push that off. We say, no, please change it. Okay. So that when the vehicle gets there, it's in as good condition as it can be.
Yeah. So you don't want me to go around knocking on their door and seeing if they've got one?
Oh, no. If their back is turned and you can hop over the fence, Charles, I'll meet you there, just the other side, just down the street.
Okay, I'm hogging the questions because nothing's coming in, and I was going to ask one more thing: is, are you thinking of branching out more? I mean, at the moment we're focused on medical care and ambulances. I mean, there is lots more to be done as well. Is that something the charity would like to broaden out on?
There is an ocean to be boiled. I think we already are a little bit broader than just ambulances and aids. So for example, we managed to buy the first all-terrain rescue crane. to be delivered by a UK group to Ukraine. I don't know how many others have been delivered, but we did that last summer, which is a wonderful thing. That's then used to lift concrete off people who are trapped under buildings that have been brought down by the Russian bombardment. Mm-hmm. Allows rescuers actually to reach people, so it makes a huge amount of difference. And remarkably, because these things are very expensive pieces of kit, remarkably, I think we're on the cusp of being able to buy our second one, which would be a wonderful thing. And that is funded. You know, we are volunteer led. We are funded purely by donations. And so when we're able to buy pieces of equipment of that scale and impact, it shows just how deep the well of support for the Ukrainian plight is. Frankly, people really care about it.
Okay. Well, thank you. I'm going to hand you back to Di because I've rather hogged the season. But it's a fantastic. I mean, I've really enjoyed this morning listening to what's going on. So. Brilliant, Alia. I mean, I'm in awe of what's happened, and Daniel and Dominic. Wow, you know what? And you have a great voice, Dominic, for the radio. So if you want to become the foreign correspondent for Radio Maria, you've got
Anytime.
A job.
Is that your way of saying I've got a good face for radio, Charles?
Absolutely, and you have indeed. Bless you.
Do you have a line that we could address? Email? Is there any way you can be contacted? What is it, Dominic?
It's all one word, Medical Lifelines, and then .org.uk.
Okay, that's great. Thank you. I think we've got to say goodbye, but it's been an absolutely fascinating, informative, really moving series of, it's not stories, it's events. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, Alia, Daniel, Dominic. Thank you. Goodbye.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. This was a Radio Maria podcast. If you enjoyed it, do please click like and subscribe on your podcast provider or leave us a review. Every bit of feedback helps increase our visibility and allows us to reach more people with the message of Christ's saving truth. And if you don't already, you can listen to Radio Maria live either online or on DAB in selected regions of the UK. We'd love for you to call in live and be part of the conversation. See our website radiomariaengland.uk for more details and a full schedule of programmes. And do please consider making a donation so that we can keep making more programmes like this. We are completely dependent upon the generosity of our listeners.